How will the more expansive negative option rule proposed by the FTC and the current and proposed state auto renewal laws change the way companies offer subscription and continuity products? I'm Po Yi, and this is Perfect Balance, an advertising law podcast from Monat. I love the ease and convenience of subscribing to content that interests me, like news, magazines, and streaming service, as well as products that I consume regularly, like coffee. I know that once I sign up and add credit card information to my subscription account, I don't have to worry about running out of my favorite coffee beans or losing access to my favorite shows until I don't want them anymore. I'm not always on top of my subscriptions, and I end up paying more or longer than I intended to for products and services that I no longer want, and cancellation is not always easy. I could have easily avoided such unwanted consequences by reading the disclosures carefully before I sign up, but notwithstanding my profession as a lawyer, I often don't pay attention to them depending on where and how they are presented. The subscriptions that I just described, automatically renewed subscriptions and continuity plans, are two most common forms of marketing programs generally known as negative options. These programs have come under heavy scrutiny by the Federal Trade Commission, or the FTC, as well as various states in recent years. In March of 2023, the FTC proposed major amendments to the existing negative option rule. We're expecting to see the final rule published this year. We're also continuing to see a lot of enforcement actions and litigation based on the existing automatic renewal laws at the state level, and more states appear to be poised to pass their own automatic renewal laws. To discuss what this legal and regulatory trend means for companies, I've invited my partners JJ Rodriguez from our LA office and Eric Gold from our Boston office to join me today. JJ is a partner in Monat's Consumer Protection, Advertising, and Class Action Defense Group, and he defends clients throughout the United States in class actions and regulatory proceedings related to automatic renewal laws. Eric is a Monat Health partner, and before joining the firm last year, he was an assistant attorney general in the Massachusetts Attorney General's office for more than 10 years, the last five of which he served as chief of the healthcare division. Eric and JJ, welcome.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for having us, Paul.
Before we start to discuss the FTC's proposed negative option rule and state automatic renewal laws, Eric, could you take us through the types of consumer products and programs that are generally covered by these laws?
Yes, I'd love to. The FTC in the new rule describes four features of consumer products. They call these first the pre-notification plans, second are continuity plans, third automatic renewals, and fourth free trial marketing. I'll try to describe what they mean by each of them and then give an example. So first, the pre-notification plans, these are really the oldest and the only one that's regulated by the current FTC negative option rule. A typical pre-notification plan is where a consumer signs up in advance and then receives a periodic notice offering a good or a service for sale, and then the consumer will receive and be charged for the good unless they tell the seller that they don't want it. You can think of this as a product of the month. The second category is a continuity plan, and this is where a consumer agrees to receive regular deliveries of a particular product, and they receive those deliveries until they cancel the plan. An example of this is the coffee beans that you subscribe to or a bottled water delivery in the older days. The third category is what they call automatic renewal, and that's any subscription that renews automatically at the end of the period that the customer has paid for, unless the customer affirmatively cancels. So this can happen, for example, with a magazine subscription or any sort of online service. And then the fourth category is free trial marketing. And as the name suggests, this is where a company offers a good or service for free or a nominal charge for a period of time. And then after the trial period, begins to charge the consumer unless they affirmatively cancel or return the goods that they've purchased. Free trials may be parts of lots of subscriptions, including video or audio service subscriptions. And of course, particular subscriptions can fall into more than one of these categories. There might be a continuity plan, that is a coffee bean delivery, that also has an automatic renewal feature and may also have a free trial component.
So what are the underlying principles and policies behind the rules and laws that we currently have or are being proposed? What are the concerns that regulators and states have regarding these negative option programs?
There are really four principles that the law requires that these types of products might meet. The first is clear and conspicuous disclosure of the material terms. So that includes the price of the good or service the customer is buying, the length of the subscription, and the good or service that's being sold. The second is the timing of the disclosure, and that is that the disclosure must be before the consumer signs up and gets charged. The third is consent. And you'll see there's lots of discussion about what it means for a consumer to consent to a auto renewal or negative option plan, including discussion in the FTC. But at a minimum, you'll need some evidence that the consumer agreed to purchase the good and sign up for the service before they are charged. And then lastly is easy cancellation. Again, there's lots of debate about how easy the cancellation must be, but there's a long history of cases where consumers reported that cancellation was impossible or quite difficult and they needed to jump through lots of hoops. So the principle is that the consumer has to be able to cancel to avoid a finding of unlawful conduct.
Eric, thanks for the overview of negative option programs and for taking us through the basic principles, all of which, as a consumer, make sense to me. JJ, you're a litigator, but you've been increasingly involved in providing compliance counseling to clients on automatic renewal programs. I think that may be largely due to a spike in litigation based on state automatic renewal laws that have been enacted or broadened in the last few years, particularly in California, but in other states as well. What are the common areas of concern for marketers under existing laws? There's so much to worry about here.
That's absolutely right. There is a lot to worry about. And let me start by saying it used to be easier. It used to be that you could follow a statute like California's, which remains arguably the most strict in the country, and call it a day. If you complied in California, you complied with the rest of the country and probably with federal rules as well. That's no longer the case. The country is divided roughly into thirds, with about one third of the states having a law that's broad like California. It applies across industries. Another third of the states with much narrower laws that might be industry specific. Gyms is a common example. Just under another third who either have no automatic renewal law per se on the books, although they might have an unfair competition law or something similar that can be applied to similar circumstances. So compliance is tougher because we have such a diverse matrix of laws. The law, though, you won't be surprised, overlaps almost precisely in various jurisdictions with the principles that Eric just talked about. A couple of big areas of concern right now, I think the hottest spot is probably cancellation. Early litigation and automatic renewal law class actions focused almost exclusively on the clear and conspicuous disclosure requirement and consent. That makes sense. They're really technical laws. California, which is sort of the exemplar for the rest of the country, has a precise definition of clear and conspicuous. And whether you think it's clear and conspicuous from the perspective of a reasonable consumer or not is almost irrelevant. For example, the text of an automatic renewal disclosure, it can't be smaller than the surrounding text. It's just a technical requirement. And so the technicality of it allows plaintiffs, attorneys, to click through websites, identify a violation, find a client, put together a lawsuit, and usually settle fast and make a little money from it. It wasn't happening with cancellation, but the cancellation trend has created new opportunities for litigation and enforcement. The old rule was make it easy. Easy to use, simple cancellation mechanism, online, telephone, paper enrollments, regardless of the method used to enroll a new customer, you had to make it simple and easy to use. That's the language most statutes had, simple, easy to use. We now have two permutations. There's the mirrored approach and the immediacy approach. Under the mirrored approach, which is part of the FTC proposed rule, the cancellation mechanism has to mirror the mechanism that was used to enroll a new consumer. An early version of this was California. If you have a customer who signs up exclusively online, then they have to be able to cancel them. You can't require them to make a phone call. Lots of states are doing that. Although Idaho, I think effective January 1st, went in the other direction and got rid of their mirroring rule. In every other instance, states get more stringent. The other approach is immediacy. And that too is part of the FTC proposed rule. In California, immediacy means immediacy. The rule is that for online subscriptions, businesses have to have either a button on the account page that a customer can click and immediately cancel without further steps, or a pre-formatted email that they can send requesting termination. Those are very stringent technical requirements. And so now we're seeing lawsuits. It doesn't matter how compliant a company is. They can follow every aspect of an automatic renewal statute in all states. If you trap your customers and they can't get out easily, it's a violation of the law.
With a growing number of states with automatic renewal laws that often include technical requirements, which are not always consistent, what major shift in litigation are you seeing now?
We're moving away from really focused litigation on disclosure that is not clear and conspicuous to kitchen sink litigation, where a complaint will allege a violation of disclosures that aren't clear and conspicuous, a failed consent mechanism, a really long cancellation mechanism, and a failure to give a pre-renewal notice. Something that we've seen probably in the last year, or maybe a little earlier, is class actions are no longer limited to particular states. Most of them are, but most class actions are in California, states like Illinois, Oregon. We're now seeing cross-jurisdictional litigations. For example, Amazon right now is facing litigation under both Oregon and California's automatic renewal laws in federal court in Washington state. And at the same time, in the same court, they're defending against a lawsuit brought by the FTC, alleging basically the same package of violations. So threats are no longer state-specific. Companies have to be prepared to comply across jurisdictions nationally. And in litigation, might face plaintiffs who are suing for damages on behalf of a class that is not limited to a specific jurisdiction.
Eric, it seems to me that under these laws and regulations that are currently in effect, marketers certainly have a strong incentive to ensure that their negative option programs are consumer-friendly in accordance with the basic principles that you described at the beginning of our discussion. Then why is the FTC proposing the new comprehensive negative option rule?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's maybe worth taking a step back. So the negative option rule has been around for a long time. It was first issued by the FTC in 1973, and despite lots of discussion and requests for information, it has not been updated in now almost five decades. And in the meantime, there have been other new laws applying to the internet and to telemarketing that do regulate subscriptions in various other specific ways. The FTC's argument, or at least what they claim in the notice of rulemaking, is that really, the purpose of the proposed rule is not to change the law, but to put all of these, at least federal requirements, all in one place. So it's easier for businesses to find and to understand. They also acknowledge, and this is where business and industry has really pushed back, that the main point of the rule, by putting this all together, or one of the main effects of the rule, will be that the FTC will be able to seek monetary penalties for violations. They've had some authority to seek penalties in other specific statutes, but if the rule goes forward and becomes final as written, any violation of the rule, including, by the way, any misrepresentation, even in the substance, even without regard to the auto renewal feature, could give rise to these civil penalties. So that's a lot of authority and a large sort of enforcement hook, if you will, for the FTC.
As you referenced earlier, there are existing laws at the federal level that address subscriptions and other automatic renewal programs. In particular, subscriptions and continuity programs purchased online, which is how most people these days, including myself, purchase subscriptions, are subject to the Restore Online Shoppers Confidence Act, commonly known as ROSCA, that already addresses the FTC's main concerns about these programs, including disclosure, consent, and cancellation. In addition to extending the requirements set forth in ROSCA to offline transactions, what else does the FTC's proposed rule cover?
So it touches four particular issues. Disclosure, it requires clear disclosures of the subscription and the renewal, including the amount of the charges and when the cancellations will be required to avoid being charged. Second, it will require a separate affirmative consent to the auto renewal subscription, not just a consent to purchase or to enroll, but that you are consenting to auto renewal. Third, it will require, as JJ said, this click to cancel to make it as easy to cancel as it was to sign up, and also require sellers who receive cancellation to get the consumer's consent before they offer any sweeteners to stay in the product. And then there's this annual reminder that they would have to send for any auto renewal customer for any subscription that does not include physical good, so any digital subscription. So I think there's new stuff in the specifics, but the principles are the same. And again, this is all in one place. And it applies more broadly across the board to online, which, as you say, is the way all of us purchase things these days, but also on the phone or otherwise.
I agree with you, Eric, that the FTC goes into much more specificity in the proposed rule regarding what marketers should or should not do when offering and operating negative option programs, more so than they have done in the past. JJ, if the proposed rule were to be finalized substantially in its current form, and of course, this is a big if, what changes would you advise clients to make to comply with this rule?
There are some big ones. The specifics in the proposed rule are pretty detailed. It gets pretty granular at points, but I think the three big buckets that we should be counseling clients on are consent, the click to cancel rule, and saves. That's in part because the proposed rule is so specific. It's in part because it isn't always consistent with existing state law. And it's certainly inconsistent with the practices of many companies. It might be worth noting that the subscription economy is not limited to companies like Amazon. It's not just big companies. It's across markets. It's all sorts of companies, from really small startups who have been around maybe for a year or two to the largest companies that we each interact with probably on a daily basis. And so as disclosures are being developed, everyone has a different level of focus on compliance. Good thing about the FTC rule is it gives us some specifics to follow. On consent, one unique requirement is the idea that you have to maintain verification of consent for 3 years after someone subscribes, or 1 year after they cancel, whichever is shortest. That's just practically not something that a lot of companies are doing today. I think we're going to have to think for some companies creatively about what that means. What is a verification? What does it look like? How is it going to be maintained? Is it going to be enforced, and to what degree? What's the risk? Can we find a cost-effective way to do it? One of the interesting things that came up during the hearings in February is there was discussion about the cost of compliance per company. And I can tell you from practice, it's not cheap. Businesses have to ask two questions, and sometimes they're competing. How do I comply? And how do I make sure my business survives? So for all of these, I think we're going to have to work with clients to find a way, especially some of these novel requirements like verification. The other issue on consent is sort of a classic ARL problem. Is your consent mechanism only for the automatic renewal terms, or is it an all-purpose button? And practically, even as a consumer, sometimes it makes more sense to us to have something that serves multiple purposes. You're completing the transaction. You're agreeing to terms and conditions, you're acknowledging a privacy policy, and you're acknowledging the auto renewal terms. The new trend, including the one in the FTC proposed rule, is you can't put it all together. At minimum, you've got to pull out the auto renewal terms and have a separate consent for it. That is a pretty major endeavor. It means overhauling the checkout pages for most companies, or the final step of the enrollment process. And it really causes concerns with retention. To some companies, I think it risks confusion on a web page. So it requires testing, a lot of mockups of pages, and really quite a while to comply. The saves rule is also pretty interesting. It's a good example of how a particularly strict compliance provision in the proposed rule is potentially at odds with really strict state law. California, for example, also a click-to-cancel state, doesn't arguably permit save attempts prior to the cancellation. The regulators here, the California Automatic Renewal Task Force, would say that immediate means immediate, and the cancellation has to happen, and then you can try to get them back. You don't get to make a save attempt before you cancel. The FTC rule provides a way where you can do that. Following it here would arguably violate California's pretty strict automatic renewal law. Is it possible to craft a provision that complies with both? Probably, but it might mean no save attempts. It might mean that a company does not get to take advantage of the FTC's invitation to seek a one-time consent to make a save attempt. Haven't seen that litigated out, not sure how it'll go, but it's an interesting compliance problem. And then finally, and relatedly, is the click to cancel issue. What does immediate mean? Does it actually mean immediate? Does it mean you'll immediately start processing it? The FTC at least gives us an answer. It says you can make a save attempt, and if the customer says no, the cancellation has to occur with no further attempt. So not that tough there. But in California, the FTC rule really presents a problem.
What about the annual reminder requirement in the FTC's proposed rule? Does California have a different notice requirement? What about other states?
I think it's really interesting that the FTC rule only requires an annual reminder. And the way they got there is interesting too. They really find that there's the lack of reminders does not create an inherently unfair or deceptive act. Because if you're compliant with everything else, the customer should know what they're signing up for. They should know when the renewals are coming. And of course, they carve out an exception for physical goods, because that is sort of a reminder every time it arrives on your doorstep. In any event, many states, at least a third like California, have very specific notice requirements. So the discussion here, and I think not all clients get this, is complying with the FTC rule. If it goes through as proposed, as strict as parts of it are, it's not enough. If you send an annual reminder and that's it, particularly if it's the one the FTC envisions, it's not going to pass muster in many states. And I think in the FTC's proposed rule, they use language something like a simple general email. A simple general email will not do the job in California.
Eric, as a former member of the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office, can you tell us how state AGs use existing general UDAP laws to protect consumer rights relating to subscription and continuity products? I know that Massachusetts currently has a bill that specifically addresses automatic renewals, but even without an automatic renewal law currently in effect, like the ones that California and my home state, New York, have, Massachusetts and other states have lots of existing tools to go after bad actors.
Oh, that's definitely right. The state attorney general's offices have a long history of investigating and in some cases litigating cases that involve what they would describe as unfair and deceptive conduct in subscriptions and other auto renewal products. The tool of choice historically has been state unfair and deceptive acts and practices laws, sometimes called UDAP, which generally prohibit unfair or deceptive practices, and every state has one. States have used these laws where they see areas of concern around what we've talked about, where there's not appropriate disclosure upon enrollment, where there's evidence that the consumers haven't consented, and where there are concerns about cancellation, where state attorney generals get complaints that customers are enrolled in subscriptions that they didn't intend to enroll for or sign up for. They would view that as a classic deceptive practice. And similarly, where they have complaints or evidence that it's been very difficult or even impossible to cancel a subscription, that's the type of unfair practice that state attorney generals have typically used the UDAP statutes for to investigate and, if necessary, sue to stop. Just to give one example of a large case from some time ago, it was 2014, there was what we call a multi-state investigation. 45 state attorney generals investigated and settled with the large satellite radio company. And there were allegations of violating state UDAP laws related to this subscription service. And it alleged many of the concerns that you see in the FTC's new rule. The concerns are allegations of auto-renewing subscriptions without consent, concerns or allegations of charging credit cards without consent, making it difficult to cancel, not providing refunds, and general misrepresentations about consumers as to whether their products were refunded or not. So there was a multi-million dollar penalty and agreement to change practices. And similar cases have happened more recently. There was a case out of my old office in Massachusetts just settled last year after several years of litigation involving a home security system company, a subscription-based home alarm. There was a $6.5 million payment. And that involved, again, lots of different sets of allegations, but the core was that the company made it really difficult for customers to cancel their subscriptions. People would submit allegedly written requests that were being ignored. They would tell people their subscriptions had been canceled when they really hadn't, and that people were thinking they were canceling, they were actually renewing their agreements. So again, this is a case that without any auto renewal or negative option rule under the traditional UDAP statute, the Attorney General's office is sued and collected a multi-million dollar penalty.
JJ, earlier you discussed litigation trends based on state automatic renewal laws. What effect do you think the proposed FTC negative option rule would have on litigation at the state level, especially on private litigation? Will there be any material effect since the existing state automatic laws appear to provide enough basis for these lawsuits?
You're not wrong that the state laws, at least the states that have them, do provide a sufficient foundation for a ton of litigation, which is what we're seeing in California. Very quick sort of historical background. I think the way that many companies have been attacked in the past is a one state at a time approach. So that there are defendants who have had to defend automatic renewal litigation in California and in Oregon, and you know, maybe North Carolina and other states that have similar statutes. The trend over the last year has been to put those separate lawsuits together if you have the class representatives to pull that off, and even allege a national class. Now, technically, the private litigant doesn't sue under the FTC Act. So we don't see the emergence of national classes as a direct result of changing the negative option rule. But we are seeing even the proposed cited in cases that are asserting a national class. I saw a complaint, even in state court, filed here in Riverside, alleging in the first few pages of the complaint what a pervasive problem we have, and citing the proposed rule and some of the statements made in the hearings as evidence of what a big public problem we have. I don't think you have to take a huge intellectual leap to get to something like public injunctive relief, for example, in California. But those sorts of findings are relevant because there are remedies under state laws like California that get you to attorney's fees if you get a public injunction, for example, for the benefit of the public. So all of that stuff goes into the mix. It also, I think, is having an impact on people's enforcement actions. And in that context, I think regulators are not afraid to rely on ROSCA, the negative option rule, looking to consent judgments through the FTC as a standard for how much money they should demand from a defendant in a pre-litigation investigation and ultimately to settle claims in state court. So I think the rule is really going to inform and support the way that litigation state by state is already happening. The second impact is we are seeing at least an attempt at certifying national classes. We've seen a lot of class actions allege a national class, and we're usually able to beat those back in one-on-one discussions with counsel or motions to strike. But I think when the plaintiff's bar sees an eight-figure payday coming out of a national class, they are thinking, how can I do it too?
This topic is truly fascinating and unnerving for marketers. Everyone is watching. The industry is watching. Before we end today's episode, I'd like to ask each of you to provide a couple of tips for marketers to mitigate risk in light of the ever-growing list of state automatic renewal laws and the proposed FTC rule on negative options. Eric, let's start with you.
On the legal side, just to repeat what we've been saying, know your state laws and state requirements, mind them as well. There's so much attention on this FTC rule that there is a tendency maybe to ignore or forget the state law. But the FTC rule specifically carves out state laws that are more protective of consumers, more restrictive on business. And so folks need to remember, if you're online and selling to California consumers, you got to comply with California law. If you're selling to Massachusetts consumers, you got to comply with Massachusetts law. From a regulator perspective, when all else fails, lots of disclosure is never a bad thing when a regulator is considering whether to take enforcement. Sending regular emails to your customers, even if they may not be required under the FTC rule, that's a good piece of evidence in your favor when the customer complains that they didn't even know they were subscribed or know they were being charged. So lots of disclosure during the sign-up process and routinely is always good practice.
And JJ, what's your tip?
Well, I'm going to borrow Eric's final tip because it deserves reiterating. More disclosure is better. Don't look at the statute or any rule as the end of the conversation. In litigation, in negotiations with regulators, if we're able to say, notwithstanding some technical deficiency that may exist in a disclosure on a checkout page, my client have all of these other disclosures in the enrollment process, leaving no doubt what somebody was signing up for. It goes a long way with courts, juries, regulators. So more disclosures are great. Second, a little common sense goes a long way. Your cancellation process, if the number of minutes it takes is double digits, you probably have a problem. Double digit cancellations are not that uncommon. It shouldn't be onerous. Companies should know how long it takes. They should know what the average cancellation is, and they should think about it. Disclosure of automatic renewal terms, don't make them smaller than everything else on the page. I have seen judge after judge not look at the technical statute, just look at a piece of paper that has a disclosure printed on a screen. And even though they will ultimately apply the law, you can see them just asking themselves, is it good enough? Do I know what I'm signing up for? They take a common sense approach to the decision. I look at every client's page, and the first thing I do is just common sense. Do I know? Do I get it? Will my mom get it? Will my partner get it? Common sense goes a long way in compliance. You still have to comply with the technical parts of the statute, but don't throw common sense out.
I agree wholeheartedly. Thank you, Eric and JJ, for joining me to discuss the expansion of the negative option rule proposed by the FTC and for sharing your perspectives on how this will affect the way companies offer and operate subscription and continuity products. And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again for this episode of Perfect Balance, an advertising law podcast from Manat. To learn more about this topic, please see the various articles and other related resources listed in this episode's caption. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Perfect Balance, an advertising law podcast from Manat, to receive updates about future episodes.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Perfect Balance, an advertising law podcast from Manat. The views expressed on the podcast reflect the personal views and opinions of the participants and are not intended to constitute legal advice or counsel under any circumstance. Downloading and listening to this recording do not result in the formation of an attorney-client or other business relationship. You should not act on any information in the podcast without seeking the advice of a competent attorney licensed to practice in your jurisdiction.